Japan. I have to eat that motherfucker.
That was so long, Chong. So long, Chong. I've got tomorrow night.
Yeah, man, ich bin so ein bisschen massiver für die Angelis. Sehen Sie sich auch in dem Rapper?
Ja, in dieser zweiten Stunde von Axiom setzen wir das Gespräch mit Bill Freund über die indische Community in Durban fort. Er spricht gerade über, wie Gandhi nach Durban gekommen ist.
Indian free migration of merchants to South Africa. They experienced various disabilities, as they called it, and he was the one who was supposed to defend against that. And he gradually developed a political practice out of that and developed his philosophy here, had his children here, one or two of whom he left in South Africa. And he lived here for a long time, for 25 years or so.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, 20 years approximately.
Yeah.
No.
So,
And once he left, never came back. But he corresponded with people here.
Yeah.
And he had a son here.
Yeah. Okay. And which role did he play here? Did he accept this racial system here? Or what was his position to the?
He. It's a good question, and you should probably read about it more rather than. I think he accepted it, maybe not at a philosophical level, but at a practical level, yes. But he struggled to improve the position of Indians within it.
Yeah.
But he didn't try to challenge it writ and branch.
Yeah. So he had this idea that he is that the black Africans are treated for work, maybe for the Indians.
He thought of the black Africans as the rather primitive native people of the country who were sometimes quite badly treated. They didn't think of them as equal citizens in a modern state, frankly. Certainly not in 1900.
Yeah.
But he thought that in Natal there was it's complicated story, but there was what you call the Bambata Rebellion, which was repressed very brutally. It got the settlers into trouble with the British. It's one reason why Natal was forced to become part of the Union of South Africa.
Yeah.
And he was an ambulance driver for the British military, but at the same time he didn't like the abuses he knew that there were going on.
Yeah.
So that would give you, maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
Look, his closest friends and associates were white.
Yeah.
When you start talking about Phoenix Farm and Satyagraha.
Yeah.
And his philosophy.
Yeah.
As opposed to his marches in order to help the merchants.
Yeah. Okay.
So he certainly saw whites as his, you know, natural equals. He'd lived in Britain. Probably, nobody ever writes about it, but he probably had an affair with his secretary.
Oh, yeah.
It's a nice, very devoted Jewish woman who wrote to him all their lives. His closest friend and associate here, Kallenbach, who is also Jewish, was a very successful architect. Conventional architect, built some of the big buildings in Johannesburg.
Yeah.
But was attracted to Gandhi's philosophy when he was a young man.
Yeah.
So, you know, he didn't believe in race as a principle at all.
Yeah.
He was very much an English gentleman when he came out. I think he shared the same views as the nicest and most enlightened, but rather paternalistic, white British people of his time.
Yeah.
Towards Africans.
Yeah, okay.
If that makes some sense.
Yeah. There are some very old Jewish families here in Durban.
Yeah. they were very important in this little alternative world he created at Phoenix Farm. Yeah. He was also, it's hard to, well, one person did a paper on him. It was very convincing. In a lot of ways, what Gandhi was an early hippie.
Yeah.
He was. Right. He was. It was an alternative in all terms of health and diet and all these kinds of things. And so attracted people who liked that sort. Because there was already a beginning of this in the West before World War I. And those people usually didn't really like Gandhi.
Yeah.
The simple life, you know, you just go around in this sheet and spin. This is good. And, you know, a different moral system, etc. He was a pioneer of that.
Yeah.
And he appealed to Western Europeans this way, more than to anybody else.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of what actually went on every day, rather than Gandhi, some campaigner against the government.
Yeah. All
right. But the Indian, he made his living as a lawyer. And then he shifted, though, to run this newspaper, but it was very much aimed for Indians.
Yeah.
But there was always, I should think, some barrier between him and Muslims. And there was a big barrier between him and the massive, illiterate, indentured workers from India.
Yeah.
There's an argument by Maureen Swan, which I think is quite convincing, that when they engaged in a huge kind of labor revolt, a massive strike, at a certain phase he joined in and supported them.
Yeah.
And that was quite critical, and he learned a lot from it. That's 1913. But it was a new thing for him. These weren't these weren't the people he sat around and had coffee with every day, by any means.
Yeah.
He had very little to do, and there were also the South Indians who didn't speak their language. There was quite a gap.
Yeah.
Only where their leadership in the next generation had become educated and English-speaking would he have had much ability to connect to them.
Yeah.
And you can compare, I mean, in India, of course, he was also very ambiguous. He didn't want to alienate industrialists.
Yeah.
So if you compare that to the 1919 Ahmedabad strikes, where he plays an ambiguous role in his home province.
Yeah.
Between capital and labor, deliberately.
Yeah.
Get a sense of his quite complicated in this way, too. He makes a famous agreement with Smuts before he leaves, which Indians are, they withdraw this tax, which was meant to try and force Indians to leave South Africa after they got their indenture came to an end. Because most of them just stayed here. And that he got taken away.
Yeah.
And that was his strongest role politically, getting rid of special disabilities like that.
All right. Yeah.
But he is a very interesting figure, but not characteristic of anything. He's rather special.
All right. And I don't know, what was now your last publication, if it wasn't Insider and Outsider?
Well, after Insider...
Ja, das Gespräch setzen wir fort, aber mit dem Stadtplaner, mit einem der Stadtplaner aus dem Triangle-Projekt E-Trump, wo es darum geht, Durban als Stadt zu entwickeln. Und im Gespräch bin ich jetzt mit Richard Dobson.
That everything is becoming dangerous. So, what do you understand? In which area are we here, and why do people think it's not safe?
Yeah. Well, we are in a district of the inner city, so it's the Warwick Junction district. I think to understand and to unpack your question would be to look at kind of post-apartheid South Africa. In the apartheid years, this part of the city was what's known as a grey area. In other words, a grey, yes, in the sense that it was neither black nor white. They were trying to make it black by moving out the white people. Now, this all sounds ridiculous, but that's how it goes. But this area resisted that move. So although legally they were trying to make it white. In fact, it was quite a mixed community. But like any abandoned and underserviced area within the apartheid years, there was a lower standard of services. With lower standard of services came a sense of insecurity. And like any inner city internationally, there were pockets of real ghetto type existence within the area. So I think that combination of all those things kind of tagged this part of the city as well. I read one newspaper article of the day which described this area as a cesspit.
As what?
A cesspit. A cesspit would be a collection of sewage, open, exposed sewage drain, you know. So 95-96, a colleague of mine identified this area as an area for urban renewal, urban regeneration. That report was agreed by council, and progressively the city then started its inner city regeneration program. In fact, from this district, and that was in 1997-98, we started work on the ground here, putting in new capital works, starting to work with particularly the public transport ranks, working with the informal economy operators who are trading on the pavements. And then in 2002, we expanded the program to what is now known as the ITRAMP program, which is the whole of the inner city.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little map here which you can look at your leisure. So Warwick Junction now features as that district, so it's one of nine inner city districts. Obviously, this is the sea, and that's the harbour edge. So, and this brochure will show you some of the kind of stuff we did in the Warwick area. So, back to your question in terms of it being unsafe in people's minds from the past, but really through it's really community energy and community initiative. In fact, this area, in my opinion, has been made now one of the safer parts of the city. There's a very active Traders Against Crime organization. It's a trader organization, 50 or so strong traders who volunteer to...
What do you mean by traders?
Traders are the people selling goods on the pavements.
Yeah.
They have a committee structure, which is... And so they actually patrol the area and make sure that, you know, the pickpocketers and kind of the common thieves are not on the streets anymore. So they will conduct citizens' arrests. They will work with the program in terms of, you know, safety issues, etc., that we need to work on. So that's been incredibly positive.
Mm.
We've actually trained that Trader Against Crime organization in policing methods. Simple things like educating them about people's constitutional rights, how to make citizens' arrests, how to make sure that when the person is charged that they have got all the evidence, and most important that once they've charged an individual that they're prepared then to go to court and follow through the case to make sure there's a successful prosecution. In other words, we want to support a legal process in terms of apprehending criminals.
Yeah.
So that's actually been quite successful. I'm biased. This is one of my favorite parts of the city. For most people, they find it fairly hostile. I think to try and understand it as well, you need to understand the apartheid past. In the sense that if...
You grew up in Durban.
Virtually. I mean, I did my university degree here, so I've been here since 1970. But I've always been interested in development issues and kind of third world architecture and all that sort of thing. I'm an architect by background.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for me, one of the most telling things was that I had a middle-aged white woman come on one of our many walks that we do from time to time through the area. And afterwards she said to me, she said, thank you for the walk. She said, years ago I used to shop here because there's a very big fresh produce market here. She said, but progressively we stopped doing that. And she said, and this is the point of the story, she said, I'm no longer knew how the area worked. And I think that's very important for a lot of people when they feel comfortable in a city. If they know how it works and they know what you know, what pedestrian routes there are through the area. And it's just generally when you start to get a sense of well-being and you don't feel that the place is hostile, that's when you start to become more comfortable, and that's clearly when you start to make friends with shopkeepers and you build a network in a city. Now, I think that's very typical of anyone in their neighborhood where they really feel comfortable. It's they know the person who runs the corner shop, they know the person who's in the florist, and you know, except, and that's part of many aspects of South African cities now where I think South Africa is struggling, because mainly many white people feel, I think, very alienated from some of the neighborhood cultures that are developing, and they just don't feel that they can relate to that. So then one's got to listen very carefully to how they describe those neighborhoods. You know.
So and how do they describe
them? Well, often kind of critically, or they describe them in sort of hostile terms. And they will be, you know, they'll be seen as, you know, possible criminal havens and all those sort of things without really necessarily understanding them. Now, I think we mustn't be naive. There are parts of the city where we do have pockets of very entrenched criminality, but that's not dissimilar to any city than anywhere in the world. I can name them all now. We sit in an international context, and I think people really discount where we've come from in the past in terms of the apartheid city. I mean, it's unless someone really experienced it, you can't really appreciate what it meant. And for instance, the core, the inner part of the city was white. That meant that from 9 o'clock at night onwards, there were not black people in that part of the city.
Yeah.
Unless they had permits or whatever. So
1994.
Yeah, correct. So and then the quality of that urban space in terms of its cleanliness and how it was serviced, and that it was totally indulged, totally and utterly indulged, in the sense that that service was, you know, all the rates and everything was spent in that area. The property tax was spent in that area, and not in the other black dormitories or areas where we.
And now it turned around. Said now blacks are living here, and they are not getting the indulged money.
Well, no, the money is now spread evenly, but it's certainly there are parts of the city that are not serviced in the you know, to the extreme high standard that they were before. So, you know, a whole lot of people are now looking and say, oh, no, place is falling apart, and blah, blah. I mean, it's a lot of rubbish. So these are transition issues. So I think really what I'm saying is that if you looked at international cities, they would have a whole host of kind of management challenges which would be facing international cities. South African cities have those same challenges, but they have another layer of unpacking the apartheid past in the sense of things like standards. Just job seekers. I mean, if people weren't included in the white economy of the inner city. So how do you actually now start to turn that around as well?
So what happened in this center 94? How did it change that?
Okay, this one was
the whites maybe went out to other
areas.
Well,
this area is in fact quite interesting because it's unusual nationally, because this pocket here was in fact a so-called Indian group area. Alongside a white area, and then mainly the transport node was kind of African. This is kind of the grey area I described to you. So it's unusual from a South African city point of view that you had in fact a so-called Indian group so close to white. Okay, what happened then? First of all, this area here, this so-called Indian area, was an area where black people, that's African, could stay in the inner city. In fact, it was illegal, right? But that community was permitting African people to stay in accommodation that was in there. So there was absolutely no accommodation here whatsoever. I mean, it was totally oversubscribed. And you must remember that Indian people also didn't have other areas to stay around because all the top of the brewery here was mainly all white. So the moment apartheid collapsed, and particularly Indian people were now able to buy houses elsewhere, and generally it was a community which had more money than perhaps others, and people started to exercise that choice, accommodation started to become available here, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing, that people voted with their feet in the sense that if they could buy places on the Berea, now particularly in the suburbs, that's what they did. So the accommodation pressure here reduced. Certainly in the inner city here, not much changed initially, except for this area here, which is known as Albert Park, which was a very dense inner city flatland. It was apartments, all right? White owned, and a lot of them with middle-aged people, and were now approaching their retirement years and pensioners. So they really didn't have an opportunity to really move because they were living on fixed incomes. So that's been quite an interesting area where a lot of now young, fairly well-educated by profile, black people are moving into these buildings alongside elderly white pensioners, which is actually quite interesting. And now also a lot of students. So the character of that area has changed quite significantly. Beachfront in that hasn't really changed much, except for some corridors where we've got some really problematic buildings in terms of criminals having taken those buildings over, or they've just gone into decay. But that's very much like any other building. The biggest change were white-run businesses that moved out into the gateway area up on the ridge. Now, a lot of people see that as being a combination of, and notionally everyone calls it the white flight, because it first started in Johannesburg, but I think the reasons in Durban and Johannesburg are completely different. I mean, I think in Johannesburg, literally white people decided they were just going to run away and go into Sandton and areas like that. In Durban, there was an aspect of that, but I think it was purely an economic opportunity in the sense that it was an era where there were quite a few private banks established. So access to relatively small loans, but loans that were big enough to build small little office blocks, became available to big private businesses like your big law firms and your accounting firms and things like that. And with that, an opportunity to get naming rights for your building. So you now become Deloitte and Touche, whatever building, you know. And I think that was seductive to people. So not only was there the concern that maybe the inner city was going to go the way Johannesburg was going to go, in their terms, and there was an opportunity fueled by Moreland, who are a very big property group. They were selling up their sugarcane fields. And, I mean, they had masses of property holdings. And so it was an artificially kind of generated property kind of development boom that these guys fueled, but their timing was probably perfect in the sense that it played into current fears and everything else. But Durban survived, in my opinion. I mean, I don't think our inner city, our inner city is not anything like what happened in Johannesburg or any of those cities in terms of some parts of it becoming really quite decayed. Scale is much smaller. We've got an incredible amount of water around our inner city.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is the inner city, so it's not even two blocks from a water's edge, you know. So, I mean, it's actually very compact.
Yeah.
And the figures kind of show it. I mean, our program, 2002, we knew we had something like 24% office vacancy. That shrunk now down to 18% vacancy.
That's not much.
Well, in fact, the figures are a whole lot better. We don't have any vacancies in A-grade offices.
Mm.
We have something like 2 to 7%, I can't quite remember the figure, in B-grade, and then the rest is in C-grade. Now, so the 18% is really kind of artificially enlarged by this huge group that's in the C-category.
Mm-hmm.
And C-category are really offices now that are probably will never become offices again, and they're probably the ones that will be converted to residential, or they'll be demolished and rebuilt as residential units.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Yeah, the question would be in terms of city planning, what I would have to understand, I think, what was the role of architecture during the apartheid system in cities like Durban? Because... Yeah, maybe. What's your idea, Jason?
Well, I think in general, most architects and the profession could stand accused of not making more contribution to being able to be transformatory. I think that would be a general statement. However, if you were to unpack it, the question would really be, what could they have done?
Mm-hmm.
If you were employed to do a state-funded project, clearly your brief would have been to do a particular building in a particular place for a particular function.
Mm.
So the option you had is either to take that commission or not take the commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know colleagues who didn't take state commissions because they couldn't agree with them. Because, for instance, if you were to design... our magistrate's court, for instance, is a joke. I mean, it's a building just full of passages, because the idea really was is that you, black people had to be separated from Africans, had to be separated from Indians, had to be separated from whites.
Mm-hmm.
The genders had to be separated, and I mean, even down to the prisons, it was ridiculous, because then you had to separate the halal eaters from the non-halal.
Mm-hmm.
So you either had to not take on the commission. If you took on a commission for a private building owner, the area in which you were building the building was within what's known as a group area. So the building you were building would have been for the use of white people.
Yeah.
So you find that the role that architects did start to play within the apartheid government was generally then on the periphery of the city in areas where mainly African people lived, and then really tried to do innovative work in those underprovided areas. In other words, how they could be inventive in terms of bringing down building costs, building buildings that wouldn't have been built before. So it was schools, houses.
Yeah.
In my student years, we ran a student program where we, in fact, provided an architectural service to private African homeowners who couldn't get architectural advice to extend their homes or build new homes and things like that. So I think those were the levels in which people intervened. But in terms of really being able to make a structural impact on things, it was pretty much circumscribed. I mean, you really wasn't terribly much that you could do.
But in the architecture here, this is for me a kind of, or here in this more here in the center, it has more a function of representation, and it's a mixture of social realism in a way, of a socialist architecture, and a mixture of European and something else. So, what kind of architecture do we find if it's
styles?
If it's more for representation and for exclusion. Is it made for exclusion?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, in terms of the styles, I mean, someone put up a slide the other day, and I mean, I think Durban's got everything from modern, postmodern to Art Deco to, I mean, the whole lot is there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from that point of view, we are very colonial in the sense that, you know, we've just borrowed, like, everything, and you can almost kind of plot the history in terms of the buildings. a huge amount of the buildings are in private ownership. So I think the question might be, compared to a European city, and if I would think of Berlin, maybe, as an example, the state's contribution to actually creating that environment is far, far greater than it would be in a city like Durban, for instance, where, let me call it, the state or the local government's contribution is very confined. I was just talking to this reporter now. I mean, of the inner city buildings, something like only 15% is owned, of the buildings are owned by a government tier of some sort. So then it's, to answer your question, I think it's really down to the private landowners who kind of are making that kind of statement. And then it's confined to what the functions of those buildings were. And the buildings were exclusionary. I mean, they were, they had very specific, for instance, if you take all the beachfront buildings, they had very specific tenants. They were, people knew they were going to be, they're going to be white, middle class. So, you know, it was an unreal kind of situation, in the sense that you weren't designing for a whole range of income groups at that particular time.
Yeah.
As you would do now, if you wanted to be real. And I think that's why people are struggling to accept what it's going to mean to have a lot of poor and lower income earners living in the city. I mean, if you've been reading the papers and the debates, and you can see this is, you know, one of the challenges with what is a city doing with the so-called homeless, what are people doing, you know, etc. I mean, all these kind of debates.
Yeah.
And really, because we haven't been schooled like a, well, if people were to grow up in London, question of homeless would be probably a very different debate,
yeah, you know,
than a South African who came through the apartheid years.
Yeah, and if we are now here in this grey zone,
yes.
How do you work here, and what is that triangle project here?
Okay, we have a program which we call a program of district distinctiveness. What we're saying is that each of these different districts in the city,
yeah,
has a specific job or a function.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Clearly, beachfront is tourism, recreation, etc. at the point, but CBD, business sector. Now, this area is the modal interchange. This is where public transport comes in,
yeah,
both the train, buses, and minibus taxis.
Yeah.
As a result of those people coming into this area, you have a large amount of pedestrians.
Mm-hmm.
Those large amount of pedestrians provide opportunity for people to sell on the pavements.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, it's an opportunity to allow people who were previously excluded from the economy of the city to start to get an economic foothold.
Mm.
So a lot of those opportunities are for survivalists. People are making very, very minimal incomes.
Mm.
But other people have been able to use that opportunity to start pretty substantial businesses.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the program here is working with the informal economy and improving the efficiency, yeah, of the public transport ranks.
Oh, yeah. Auf jeden Fall jetzt nach dem Gespräch mit Richard Dobson über die Stadtentwicklung in Durban kommt ein Gespräch mit Richard Ballard, der eigentlich einen Background hat in Geografie, aber auch in Social Science Research interessiert ist und über Urban Social Movements und auch arbeitet und assoziiert ist am Center for Civil Society an der University of KwaZulu-Natal. Und Mitherausgeber ist er mit Adam Habib und Imran Walodia über Voices of Protest, Social Movements in Post-Apartheid South Africa. Und ja, darüber sprechen wir jetzt. You love me every day like it's for the first time. Having me as your mate, so be your first. I gotta know that if I got some love, then it's gotta show. You see, you love me every day like it's for the first time. Well, living in a suburb, you have a sense of a very small world. So we lived in a place that was basically felt like a village, even though it was a suburb of the city.
Yeah.
And it was white. It was designated for white occupation.
Yeah.
And even still today, when you look at the GIS map of Durban and racial composition, Kloof is more than 90% white.
Yeah.
So very little has changed in that part of the world in terms of racial composition. So I mean, it's probably growing up there is not all that different. The year I left school was 1990. I finished school. It was the last year that schools were segregated, so I didn't go to school with people of any other race.
Yeah.
Now that obviously wouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
But privilege has been entrenched in less direct ways now. So it's not racially exclusive, but it's quite expensive to go to that school, so it's not that easy for it to become more mixed.
Yeah.
And the area is still very, very expensive. The housing property prices are all 1.5-2 million rand upwards. Very expensive for anyone to buy in.
Yeah.
So it's stayed pretty white. But yeah, so I didn't have any black friends. I didn't have... the only black person I knew was a domestic worker. He worked in our house.
In that time?
Yeah. So, I mean, my experience was of a small little, I guess, deep settler society where people have come here, made a home in Africa, and this, you know, they've managed to create environments for themselves which are essentially quite European, to my understanding.
Yeah.
And even H.F. Verwoerd said that what they're trying to do is create little pieces of Europe on the tip of the African continent. So that's what I experienced, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And could you remember when the relationship between you and your mate probably was established and how?
She was there from soon after I was born, I think, and she left maybe, I don't know when, but when I was a teenager, she became badly diabetic, also badly alcoholic, and was fired. So she was there right throughout my teenage, my childhood. And then someone else took over who was still there at my parents' place. So, yeah, she raised us. She cooked meals for us, and she looked after us as kids. And we had very involved parents, but there was almost like an extra parent who lived there.
Yeah.
And looked after us. So I remember her well.
Yeah.
Her name was Isabel.
Yeah.
But I do remember asking my parents whether we could see her house outside of the city, and she said my mom said we're not allowed to go to those parts of the city, which was of course the Group Areas Act and the attempt to create a separate homeland. And Durban's a bit unusual because homeland regions came very close to the city.
Yeah.
KwaZulu regions came very close to the city. So she lived in one of those areas near Shongweni, and I never saw her home. I don't know what it looked like.
Yeah. But now you visit. Have you visited the home from the next year, probably?
No, but I don't know her as well. I mean, I find myself in shack settlements and townships quite a lot. So
I think I see more than a lot of white people in terms of what those areas are like, but I don't know. I don't know the home of the new person. I don't even know where it is.
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah. There's a separation.
And when you started to study, the apartheid was over.
1991, I started my degree, and it was over.
Yeah.
Ari Sitas was one of my lecturers.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah. So I did a social science degree.
Yeah. And what was the subject?
Geography, industrial labor studies, and anthropology. These were the majors. I was wanting to do town planning.
I am.
That was it.
I met Richard Dobbs.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing I wanted to do, but in the end, the geography was appealing enough to keep being an academic, so I guess that's what I've done.
Yeah.
But, so I was at this university as an undergraduate student from 91 to 94.
Yeah.
And then in 95 to 98, I went to University of Wales in Swansea to continue studying geography, so I was out of the country for 3 years.
Yeah.
And then came back to Durban. Well, it's gotten worse for most of the victims of apartheid, or the people who were marginalized under apartheid have not seen substantial improvements in their quality of life. Inequality has increased in the country, poverty has increased, unemployment has increased. The government has done some things. It has probably got one of the best welfare systems in the third world. So there's a pension system which keeps huge parts of the country going. I mean, if that wasn't there, there would have been far more political disquiet than there has been. But you see, the transition in South Africa there was a huge, obviously an amazing body of civil society in the 1980s, which was part of the liberation movement. And when the transition happened, all of those NGOs and civics and social movements and political parties became a lot more institutionalized in the 1990s. They wanted to work in partnership with the government, or indeed moved into the government itself, in order to, you know, do all the things that the apartheid government was never going to do. So there was an assumption that the new government would be the new mode of delivery for, helping people who were excluded under apartheid. But of course, what happened is conditions for those poor have essentially remained the same. And you could argue that there's a need for civil society to become quite active again. It has done so in certain areas. It has done so around HIV. It has done so around land. It has done so around evictions and service delivery in townships. So there's been some activity, and some quite militant and interesting and important activity. But it's not really coalesced into anything beyond some quite local struggles. which are very important in their own rights, but that's what they are. They are some local struggles. Obviously, the TAC's campaign was a national struggle about AIDS, and that was very conspicuous and significant. But, you know, in terms of a sustained campaign on other issues across the country, we haven't seen it yet. But last year, the government itself was reporting more than 5,000 illegal protests. So there's a lot of dissatisfaction in the country.
Yeah. Which are you documenting?
As best we can. I mean, we're not doing a good enough job in some ways, but we're tracking some of them and we're commissioning work on some of them. But there's a big gap to, you know, properly survey what's going on.
Yeah. And how do you deal in the university now with this aspect of affirmative action?
Well,
most of the researchers in the institute, as opposed to civil societies, are, I think, white.
Yeah. I mean, most academics at the university are white, and it's not changing very fast.
And so, how is this possible?
Well, I see it as two explanations.
Yeah.
The one is a job market issue, because if you have a black qualified person who would be okay to do a lecturing job at the university, they've got a master's or a PhD, they could also go into industry and earn four times what they can earn at the university in industry, and by and large that's what they do. Okay, I'm going to add a reason. The second reason is a very, very dysfunctional educational system, which is not, frankly, producing quality educated people at the rate that you would need, that you would hope. People are coming through out of schooling programs with very weak education. And that's just you know, from quite direct experience of working with people who are battling really to advance themselves through the education process. So that's the second reason. The third reason is been leveled by black academics, and I think has some validity, which is that there is some resistance to change in the institution. And people wouldn't recognize this description of themselves by and large. I mean, people aren't openly racist in the ways that, you know, would make it easy to make these accusations. But you've got an institutionalized white institution which keeps sort of re-employing people who are around and who are active and productive, and they often happen to be white. And so it's not even necessarily a very conscious kind of repetition of the system, but people aren't going out of their way to bring in, you know, new kinds of people. So it's just a combination of those three things. Those people aren't really very available. Both because the job market is attracting the good people out and the education system is not putting in enough good sort of people who are able to advance through the system. And maybe there's some inertia in the institution that is taking some time to overcome. People would be quite unhappy with the last point, but I think we have to be a bit honest about some things.
Yeah.
What I'm feeling inside and I'm trying to put it behind.
Yeah, das war Richard Ballard. Und jetzt sind wir fast am Ende dieser Aktionssendung, die ein bisschen ein Spektrum dieses 16. Weltkongresses für Soziologie, der in Durban in Südafrika Ende Juli stattgefunden hat, unter dem Motto The Quality of Social Existence in a Globalizing World zusammengefasst hat. Aber ganz zum Schluss möchte ich doch noch eine andere Position hier vorstellen, und zwar von Lawrence Hamilton, der in Durban als auch in Cambridge arbeitet, hier in Durban an der University of KwaZulu-Natal. Und zwar hat er promoviert über die politische Philosophie von Needs, also von Bedürfnissen. Und er spricht über die über den Aushandlungsprozess der südafrikanischen Verfassung, die tatsächlich all diese Probleme versucht zu bewältigen, die jetzt in diesen Gesprächen angedeutet wurden, wie zum Beispiel, wie sich jetzt Affirmative Action auswirkt oder welche Zugangsmöglichkeiten Schwarze jetzt haben, wie sich eine neue Mittelklasse herausbildet und so weiter. Was ist das überhaupt für eine Gesellschaft, mit der wir es da zu tun haben oder wie sie sich gerade rapide, rasant verändert. Also jetzt zum Schluss ein Gespräch noch mit Lawrence Hamilton. We're feeling a tender side of a man's heart that was damaged beyond repairs. Declare me as one of your innocent victims. Girl, prepare me for your heart's execution. You know it's love, girl, you know it's love.
How was the
execution
you know? Deliberated through a lot of debates in communities, people who were asked for giving their contributions. Do you think that was is that comparable to how Rawls is defining this situation where under that veil of ignorance people find their new form of constitution?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. I think the whole lot of things to say about that. First of all, that the Rawls and Dworkin's work do actually have quite a significant influence in the process of the writing of the South African Constitution, partly as a consequence of the fact that a lot of the central thinkers and framers of the Constitution, a set of liberal and left liberal thinkers who are connected to the ANC and connected they wouldn't be connected to the National Party, but they would have been connected to the ANC and sort of liberal, relatively free-thinking lawyers in South Africa, mm-hmm. had a great deal of influence in the last stages of the process of writing the Constitution.
Yeah.
Many of them are very influenced by the work of Rawls and Dworkin.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, what's so interesting about Rawls's work in particular is that, of course, in an ideal world, even in liberal terms, we would want individuals to, of course, be involved in the process of determining the nature of the Constitution. So we would want individuals to not only consent to a written constitution, but that would be vital too, but not only to consent to a written constitution, but to be involved in the way that to a certain extent they were in South Africa, to be involved in saying what kinds of concerns and goals and means, etc., that should be articulated in the constitution.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that's not what Rawls is really after at all. Rawls is after something totally different. Rawls is after he's making a kind of an analytical or hypothetical type of argument that justifies the substance of his later art. The idea of the veil of ignorance and the idea of the original position isn't equivalent, at least in my mind, to an actual political situation in which individuals would be sitting. You know, in their position, in their actual position in the world, and thinking about how the Constitution of South Africa might be formulated, he would basically want individuals to not be in their actual position, but to be in some different kind of position. Okay?
Yeah.
I don't think, in fact, that Rawls... I might be wrong about this, because I'm not really a Rawlsian scholar at all, but I don't think that Rawls is even after... The point of that argument isn't, an argument about what kinds of things people should be doing in the process of thinking about what to deliberate over when they are actually forming a constitution. It seems to me he's simply saying that if we could get into the position of being behind a veil of ignorance, these are the kinds of principles and concerns we would articulate.
Yeah.
So it is a sort of a very typical instance of the kind of political philosophy that has dominated the West ever since Thomas Hobbes. The idea of public reason.
Yeah.
In which public reason isn't in fact actually existing reason or passion.
Uh-huh.
It is the kind of principles and conceptions of justice that you'd come up with if you, as it were, only thought about things in highly constricted and ideal conditions.
Yeah.
And so the other part of that answer to your question is that there's been quite a lot said about the South African process of discussions about the new constitution and formulation of the new constitution, in which there were all of these community-based deliberations and discussions and submissions from ordinary citizens in South Africa.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a skeptic, actually, about the significance of those submissions in the final constitution. I think there's been a very good book written about this recently. Fortunately, I've just forgotten the title. But
yeah,
it seems that there's quite a lot of evidence for the fact that really what went on in the writing of the South African Constitution was a negotiated settlement between the old National Party that were going to be moving out of power and the new ANC.
Yeah.
So the National Party wanted to ensure that when they gave up power, they didn't lose everything, as it were. They wanted to make sure that their constituency retained certain kinds of goods and rights, as it were.
Yeah.
And the ANC, in the interest of the future of South Africa, in the interest of transformation, in the interest of non-violent revolution, were willing to give up on certain principles, and basically what took place was a 3-year process of negotiation between these two elite groups, the National Party and the ANC. Be flushed out of your system like mercury. Some inevitabilities to occupy and deplete your lungs' capacity. And at that, I can say, put aside your anthology. Go away for a few years and study me through an anthropology.
Ja, das war jetzt ein kurzer Einblick in die philosophischen Debatten, die jetzt auch dazu beitragen, dieses Land neu zu strukturieren, Südafrika, in diesem andauernden Prozess der Unification, die insofern wichtig ist, diese widerstreitenden Kräfte zu binden und das Land tatsächlich weiterzubringen. Wir werden diese Gespräche fortsetzen, denn es gibt noch nicht mehr Material und je nachdem, in der nächsten Aktionssendung wird diese Form der politischen Philosophie weiter Thema sein und Anfang September, 1. September in der Freitagssendung werde ich die künstlerischen Positionen darstellen, die ich eigentlich hauptsächlich in Bergen mir angeschaut habe. Okay, ja, am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich die Zerherrschaft mit dieser Aktionssendung und nachhören kann man auch unter www.fehe.org einzelne Sendungen, auch die Aktionssendung. Ja, das war hier im Hintergrund jetzt noch Hip-Hop aus Dörren. Stop making shit up and start being dead real. I paint pictures of the youth running out of time. Hopeless, death be lurking all up in my mind. Cause my pain's like 1,000 bleeding veins. And it rains every second in my fucking brain. Violent screams flick my dreams like a beaten loop. Yes, I'm armed and I will motherfucking shoot. So don't approach me for you really want this fucking beef. I'm antisocial all alone on the fucking street. See, I write from experience. Shit I've been through, shit I'm going through. Now is that what you really do? So understand, rappers, you'll be out of luck. And stay away from Dwayne Sin, he's a sick fuck.